Hi, everyone. I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Happy to be with you all tonight. So we are back at the beginning, doctor's opinion. But before we do, I just wanted to point out a few quick things in the forwards and just real quick so we can get to the doctor's opinion. In the forward to the second edition on page XV, Roman numeral 15, it says, since the original foreword to this book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. I mean, I think those words are so amazing. You usually don't hear them together, wholesale, because that means a whole bunch, and miracle together, right? Miracle, we usually think of like a burning bush or Moses parting the Red Sea, like one spectacular event. But they are saying this program produces wholesale miracles. Well, how does that happen? So the forward to the first edition, page XIII, Roman numeral 13 says, we are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, right? It seems hopeless, but it isn't. And then it says, to show other alcoholics or compulsive eaters precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So this is a textbook that's going to show us precisely how to recover. And on the next page, Roman numeral XIV 14, it says, and the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking or to stop eating compulsively. Now, I would say that's the only requirement to come to meetings, to have fellowship. But as our book tells us on page 58, if you want what we have, and what do we have? A wholesale miracle that has revolutionized our lives. Says then we have to be willing to go to any lengths to get it. And this book tells us exactly what to do. So if you are new, just, get a hold of someone who's worked through these steps, who's in love with the big book, who's in love with God, and can help you get a relationship with God. And like, this is a wholesale miracle, not a one and done miracle. So doctor's opinion, Roman numeral XXV 25. So notice it says a doctor's opinion. Well, his opinion on what? And this is his opinion on the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was written really as a book review of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it wasn't like part of the original text. It was what a doctor said about it afterwards. And so he gives it a review. And so he starts out writing, to whom it may concern. And he says, I attended a patient who was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. Well, back then they thought hopeless was bad, but what we've learned since is hopeless is really good. Because if I feel like, well, I've got hope, I could try this, that, or the other, I'm not going to work a 12-step program. Who goes to chemotherapy except the person who feels that she's hopeless, and that's her only chance of surviving cancer? And in fact, at the very beginning of the chapter, there is a solution, page 17. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. So if you're here and you're feeling hopeless, that's a good thing. That's a good thing to feel that you're hopeless on your own. And then once we feel we're hopeless on our own power, then our program shows us how to access the power that gives us all hope. So he says, okay, here's a guy who is hopeless. I'm back on Roman numeral 25, XXV. Says, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. Okay, what were these ideas he had that were fundamental to his recovery? And it's really laid out later in our book. It's basically trust God, clean house, and once you're recovered, carry this message to others. Throughout this book, there's the twin themes of faith and works, right? It says over and over, faith without works is dead. Trust God. We do what we think God would have us do in every situation and trust Him with the results. We clear away the wreckage of our past. and we help others. That is it. And we try to, again, live lives the way we think God would want us to, which means honest, self-sacrificing, putting the welfare of others ahead of our own. And it says, this is how we recover. So flip it over to Roman numeral 26, says, okay, it's not enough just to be told we can't control our drinking, that we're maladjusted to life, or we're outright mental defective. So I said, okay, in some part it's true, but there's a physical component to it, right? It's like for most of us, if we have certain foods, and again, the foods differ from one person to another, and the extremity may differ from one person to another, but we break out in more. I want more. Now I have that in some other areas of my life, right? I have that in the area of, let's say, shopping, right? I may go into Sephora to buy a lipstick and I break out in, I want more. But you know what happens? Maybe I'll buy more, maybe I won't. It doesn't impact my life. I don't go home and get into a deep depression. And I certainly don't come back the next day and buy 500 lipsticks. But I would go back and buy maybe not 500 cookies, but more cookies than I would ever want to tell anybody. So there's some kind of craving that gets set off, that when we have one bite of a food that we're sensitive to, or even something that's not on our food plan, we break out with this more. So if it was just an allergy, we wouldn't need a 12-step program. Y'all have heard me say, I'm allergic to cats. You know, I can't go near a cat or I'll, you know, have an asthma attack. I'll get sick. I don't need to go to Cats Anonymous. I don't even think there's such thing as Cats Anonymous because it's ridiculous. Anyone who has an allergy to cats simply stays away from cats. Well, then how come you don't, we can't say the same thing about, I don't know, sugar or whatever. For me, it was gum. If I chewed one piece of gum, I tried putting a limit on myself, like 5 pieces a day. Well, I'd have the 5 pieces before breakfast. So it's like, you know what? This is something I can't do. Why do we need a program? And it's because it's an allergy plus more. It says we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. I don't need to take any spiritual or altruistic action to stay away from cats. But here we have to. Spiritual. So that means I need to get right with God. And if I don't believe in God when I first come in, that's okay. I just have to be willing to believe that maybe there's a God. And an altruistic plane. That means willing to go out of my way to help other people. And it says we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. So the purpose was to clear out the alcohol so that someone could understand the 12-step program as it was explained to him. It was not like a test, like go get 48 hours sober and then we'll come to you. In fact, if we think about it, Bill Wilson got a visit from Ebby while he was drinking and planning on drinking more. Dr. Bob, his first visit to Bill Wilson, he was planning on drinking more. Alcoholics number three, AA number three in this book, he was in the hospital when they went to visit him. So I know for myself, when I heard the message and became willing, I had stuffed bagel chips down my throat behind a locked bathroom door right before the meeting. And I went and I could hear the message. I think food acts differently on us than alcohol. Overeating, I could still hear the message. So again, if you're here and you were binging right before this meeting, you can start recovering right now. Right now, you can start. So Roman numeral 27, the doctor says, we doctors realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. I think that's beautiful. So here's a doctor, a scientist, who's saying there's some kind of power of good that, if you think about it, like good is intangible, but they're saying it has a power, that this goodness is a power that we can access, that we need to apply. And then he says that many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital. And while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. This guy is in the hospital, and right away he starts putting things into practice. So I think that what that teaches us is that we do what we know, right? We may not know how to go out and help other people, to tell them about the 12 steps if we're new. But I heard a recovered alcoholic friend of mine say, anyone who walks into a meeting from their first meeting can stop lying and stop stealing. So right away, we can stop lying, we can stop stealing. And what else we can do is we can think of other people's needs. So how do we do that? We think of, okay, who are the people in my orbit, the people in my family, the people at my place of work? What can I do for them that will help them? And two ways to make it even better. One, try to do it without getting caught, almost like a secret Santa, secret self-sacrificing Santa. And then another, make it a self-sacrifice. You know, if I do something for someone else, but I really like don't mind doing it, it's like I really don't mind doing laundry. So if I do my husband's laundry, it's not really a big deal. You know, if I sit there and clean out the air fryer, that's a self-sacrifice. I don't like doing that. So we try to look for things that are a self-sacrifice from day one. In fact, when I have sponsees, I give them an assignment every day, go out and find something to do for someone else that is a sacrifice. So he says that later, this guy, his patient, requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here. You know, so often people say, oh, I'm through the steps, but I don't want a sponsor. Guys, it is a privilege to be able to get involved in God's search and rescue mission for someone else. There is nothing greater than watching dead eyes come to life again. That is like, what a privilege and what a gift. And then it says, okay, we followed some cases through, and many of them are amazing. Well, what does amazing mean? It's like unexpected, but in a good way. And what does it talk about what people have in common who work this program and are successful? Unselfishness of them. The absence of profit motive. So we never take money for this. We do this for free. And their community spirit. Like we just like hanging out with each other, talking with each other. And they say, here's how they describe people who've recovered. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So that tells a couple things about us, right? That, okay, I can have confidence, self-confidence, but it's based on God confidence, knowing that God's got my back. And then what does it tell us about God? Especially for people like me who grew up thinking that, you know, God was writing all my bad deeds down in a book, and 5 seconds after I died, he'd have this big baseball bat to bop me. It says this power pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So you just picture, right? If I was an artist, I would love to draw this, like someone just like moving toward this big gate with a skull and crossbones, you know, stuffing food in her mouth, unable to stop, and the hand of God pulling her back. And that is what the founders of this program believed about God. And that is what those of us who've gone through these steps have experienced about God. He pulls us back from the gates of death. I was a walking dead person. I never show my pictures because I was about 28 pounds heavier than I am now. So I wasn't grossly obese. But I was a walking dead person. I was dead inside. And God pulled me back. So page 28, Roman numeral 28, it says, okay, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So how do we translate that for us? That we can't use either, people call it alcoholic food, binge foods, whatever it is, we know the things we can't have. And I say it's more than that, that it's not just trigger foods, it's food outside my food plan. So if my food plan says 4 ounces of fish and I eat 4.5 ounces of fish, I've eaten compulsively. You know, that's how I do it for myself, that I like boundaries. I like knowing how much I can have and what boundaries to stay in. Because sometimes people say, well, I haven't had any of my alcoholic foods, but I've had, you know, like 2 bags of whatever, but it's not my alcohol. No, that's not abstinent. Abstinent means we have a food plan and we stick to it. Now, some people's food plans are more rigid than others. And that's okay. That's something that a person should work out with his or her sponsor. But I believe everyone should have some kind of parameters, because otherwise, how do you know if you're abstinent or not? If I say, well, I didn't eat any of my alcoholic foods, you know, but I had 3 bags of potato chips, but potato chips aren't my alcoholic food. That's not abstinent. So I think it's important that we have some kind of structure. So what do they say? These types can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit, they can't break it. They lose their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, they lose, and then their problems pile up on them. But what happens in the reverse? We find God, and God breaks the habit, breaks the obsession for us. We regain our self-confidence because it's really God confidence. We rely upon God, and we have a program that teaches us how to solve all our problems, not just our food problems, our life problems. This is what this program offers us. So then they go ahead and tell us, still on Roman numeral XXVIII 28, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Okay, I can guarantee that not one of us is here because someone said to us, you know what, you're eating too much, you're ruining your life, you're ruining your family's life, you're going to get sick, you're going to die early, you know, you're making a mess out of everything. I think you should go to Overeaters Anonymous and work a 12-step program. Please. None of us are here because of that. We're here because we hit bottom. And it says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. So both the problem and the solution must have depth and weight. So I think page 45 of our big book talks about it. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. I have no willpower. It could never work for me. Just like if someone has cancer, you can't tell them, use your willpower to make your cancer cells stop multiplying. It doesn't work that way, because the problem isn't lack of will. It's lack of power, total lack of power, zero willpower. And they say, okay, so that's the problem. And what's the solution? The main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So we're here for fellowship. We're here for support. We're here to get a one-on-one sponsor to guide someone through the steps. But a job of a sponsor is to take her sponsee's hand and put it in the hand of God. That's really what this is about. We need to find a power greater than ourselves, it says. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. God is not in the, you know, put a patch on it and mend it business. God is in the transformation business, right? Caterpillar to butterfly stuff. Recreate our lives. We become different people. And so they go ahead and they talk about We feel after many years of experience, we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. On page 20 of our big book, it says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we can help meet their needs. It does not depend on how many meetings we go to. It depends on constantly thinking about other people and how we can meet their needs. So they go ahead and say men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Okay, what's the effect? It's usually a blot out, to just blot out our pain, but not always, as we'll see. And it says the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And that's so sad, right? When we think that our life in the food, getting the food, stealing the food, getting a replacement, eating the replacement before we get it back, that that seems normal to us. They say, no, it doesn't have to be that way. And then they talk about what we're like in the illness. We are restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks or bites, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Okay, why do people get restless, irritable, and discontent? Restless, bored. Okay, if I'm bored, I'm thinking too much about myself and my pleasure and not enough about other people. Irritable. Well, if I'm irritable, it means I'm not getting my way. Well, the solution to that is to not have a demand to have my way, to not have to have everything go the way I want it. And discontent. If I'm not content, it means I have demands that things be a certain way so that I'll be happy. And what this program teaches me is I have to learn to live with discontent. I have to learn with not always getting my way. I have to learn to live with things like that. And that's what these great steps teach us. That's the beauty of the fourth step and the 10th step. It teaches us how to deal with it when we're angry, when we're afraid, what to do when we've caused harm. And then, of course, step 12 gives us a way to never be restless or bored because, you know, we get our creative juices going by helping other people. And it says, yeah, we took drinks which we see others taking with impunity. I mean, I have a daughter in her 20s and I've seen her go through a bad night, a breakup or something. And she'll eat like, I don't know, a pint of ice cream, half a pint of ice cream, which is even more weird. And then the next day be fine. I mean, that's what some people can do, but not us. We are, in this chapter, it talks about a distinct entity. We can't do things that other people can do. It's like our DNA is different. I cannot go into pet stores like most other people can do because something in me is different and, you know, I'll get all sneezy and sniffly and sick. I just can't. So I can sit there and throw a fit that I can never go into a pet store the whole rest of my life. Or I could just deal with it and just say, well, there's lots of other really great things in life and I'll learn to be happy without it. So they say that after we've succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, we pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of recovery. So the craving starts, we go on a binge, we're remorseful, and we say, I won't do it again. We make a resolution. Now, we can all make certain resolutions. I moved down south over the summer and I bought a bunch of new clothes because people just dress differently here. And at the end of the year, I said, I have really spent too much money on clothes and I didn't feel good about it. So I just made a resolution that for 3 months, like until April 1st, no matter what, I was not going to buy one single piece of clothing. And that's a resolution that I on my own willpower, have the ability to keep. And yet there were days when I said, I am not going to overeat. And I couldn't even make it to work in the morning without eating compulsively, because there is a difference. What's the difference? And we'll get more into that as we go through the early chapters in this book. We have a strange mental blank spot that we forget that if I have one bite, I'm not going to be able to stop, and I'm going to eat the whole box, carton, gallon, package, whatever, and then go on and on. We forget that we're unable to do that. So we make a resolution not to do again. But again, we don't have the power to keep our resolutions. But here's where the hope starts. It says this is repeated over and over, the binging, the remorse, the resolutions, until we have a psychic change. They say that's our only hope, but it's a great hope. And what is a psychic change? So on page 25, regular 25, it says the great fact is just this and nothing less, so that we should settle for nothing less. We have had deep and effective spiritual experiences, a psychic change. What does it do, our psychic change? Revolutionizes our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives, or into our hearts and lives, in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. It's basically God coming in and rewiring our heart, a psychic change. And then it tells us, on the other hand, and strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the same person who seemed doomed suddenly finds himself easily, see that word, easily able to control his desire for alcohol or food not on his food plan, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules, not optional suggestions, rules. We have to make amends, right? We have to make sure we keep nothing to ourselves when we do our inventories. We have to be honest. But when we do these things, it gets easy. And then, like, just one of the saddest chapters in the book, the doctor says, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Well, that was me for years. And for years in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, I was sincere and I was despairing. But desire alone isn't enough. Right? No one would ever tell the poor person with cancer, well, if your cancer cells are still multiplying, you must not have a strong enough desire to recover from cancer. That would be mean. But that was the kind of stuff that was said to me. But our book on regular page 24 says, at a certain point of the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Desire is only good if it's coupled with action, and only if it's correct action. Again, for 6.5 years, some very lovely people told me some stuff to do. It didn't work because they didn't tell me I had to be honest, that I had to get a relationship with God, which was basically characterized by me surrendering to his will as best I knew, right? I didn't know much, but I knew I can't lie. I knew I had to help people and then to clear away the wreckage of our past. So it says, if a doctor is honest with himself, he'll feel his own inadequacy. He feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Well, of course, a miracle, that's what's required. But luckily, as it says in chapter 4, this book gives us like the recipe for a miracle. It's like, they could have called this book, How to Have a Miracle in 12 Simple but Not Always Easy Steps, a miracle. And he says, we physicians have to admit, we really haven't made a dent in the problem. Many types don't respond to the ordinary psychological approach. Well, of course not, because no matter how lovely a psychologist is, He or she can't turn a caterpillar into a butterfly. Only God can do that. So he goes ahead and says, I don't hold with those who believe alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control, agreed, or even emotional overload. Sometimes people say, well, I binge because, you know, I just had like too much fear, too much this, too much, you know, too much emotion I couldn't handle. But he gives an example here of, you know, guys who things are fine and they're about to settle a problem or a business deal the next day, and then they take a drink the day before. And it's not because, says page Roman numeral XXX, they weren't trying to escape. It wasn't because they were uncomfortable, but there was a craving beyond their mental control. Our book says that once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So this illness starts in our spirit. It's, you know, and we have to recover first spiritually, but it sets up command central in our minds and it calls the shots. And it just likes kind of playing cat and mouse with us. So it'll say, oh, you have a business deal tomorrow? I think I'm going to make you binge tomorrow. Oh, you know, it's Tuesday. I think I'm going to make you binge today. We have no say in it. And it goes on to say that there's lots of types of people like us. There's the psychopath. There's the person who is always going on the wagons for keeps. It says they're over remorseful. We're all over remorseful, right? The day after. And make many resolutions, but never a decision. Okay, what's the difference between a resolution and a decision? And, you know, I used to think it was, well, a resolution is I won't do this, and a decision is I will do this. But that's not right. What they're talking about here is their step three decision, a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. That's what's needed. And so it talks about all the different types. There's manic depressive. There's types who say, well, if I change this or I try to manage this way. And it says, all of us have one thing in common. As soon as we start, we develop the phenomenon of craving. Once the first compulsive bite comes, we can't stop. Well, so a normal person will say, well, then just don't take the first compulsive bite. I had a friend, Lizette, her husband saw that if he took even one glass of wine, he couldn't stop. But he hadn't crossed the line yet. So he said, you know what? I'm done. I'm never again going to have a glass of wine. And to my knowledge, he hasn't. So for him, what happens to a person when they have a glass of wine is irrelevant because he just doesn't. But for people like me, I could know if I have one this, if I go off my food plan this little bit, I'm going to end up binging my brains out. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. And it tells us, you know, there they say, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. They meant entire abstinence from alcohol. I believe for us, it means entire abstinence from compulsive eating. And again, that's something we define with our sponsors. It says, this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. There's some people who say, you know, a food plan should only be three meals a day. And no one can have snacks no matter what, even if there's a medical thing. There's some people who say no one should ever have any kind of flour. But our book tells us we've resigned from the debating society. So that's a discussion that someone should have with her sponsor, her nutritionist, her doctor, and God, and come to some kind of a resolution. So top of Roman numeral 31, XXXI, it says, what is the solution? The solution to not picking up the first one. And then he says, okay, I'm not going to answer directly. I'm going to give you some human examples. And right, isn't that why we tell our stories at meetings, right? We don't just hand everyone a big book. We have speaker meetings so we can see what we were like, you know, what we were like, a hot mess. What happened? We got a relationship with God. And what we're like now, stable, helpful, healthy people. So he talks about a guy who came in who had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him, there was no hope. So he hit a bottom. He knew he was hopeless. says he accepted the plan outlined in this book. So he was willing to go to any length. He did the work. And then look at this transformation. This is caterpillar to butterfly stuff, guys. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. He says, a long time has passed with no return to alcohol. So guys, recovery can be permanent. It can be forever. And then he says, well, I'm thinking of another guy, a guy who hid in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and desperate condition, brought to the doctor, and then he started working this program. And to me, that's interesting because here's a guy who went off on his own. And what did his friends do? Did they say, we'll just leave him on his own, you know, determined to die? They didn't. They reached out to him. So, you know, every now and then I think of like sponsees I have who've left or friends I've had who've left, and I reach out to them. You know, I'll send them a text. I'll call them, you know, how are you doing? Just to kind of be a lifeline that if someone wants to come back in, you know, they don't have to crawl on their hands and knees. We help them to walk in with dignity. So the very last page on the chapter, XXXII, he talks about, he says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Beautiful last sentence. So it says, don't write off scoffers. If someone's sitting there saying, oh, this program's a bunch of bull, but they're sitting there and they keep coming and they keep coming, well, let them scoff. He may remain to pray. And what are the doctor's last piece of advice? Pray. Why? Because prayer actually does something, because there is a God who's on the receiving end of prayer. And prayer activates the miracle. So again, what does he say? Read this book, read it through, meaning not just read it, do it. And then pray, read this book and pray. And that is all I have. Thank you.